Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I'm your host, Michael Cutler. I thank you for joining me. I hope you've all had a good week. We're getting started in this new year with lots of possibilities, lots of challenges, interesting times. You know, the Chinese have that curse. May you live in interesting times. Certainly, these are indeed very interesting times. Thrilled to be joining you at the end of every week, as I do Fridays at the same time, and I thank you for joining me. And it's really a pleasure to be here with you, visiting, discussing the issues of the day that, quite frankly, all too often are not being covered by most of the mainstream media. Although, I have to tell you, I've been on the Neil Cavuto, if you've been noticing, the past couple of weeks. It's been a pleasure to join Neil on his terrific program and talk about the immigration issue. But if you notice, very few politicians are really willing to take the issue on directly. They play the game. You know, we'll talk about the Mexican border. We'll talk about going after the employers. But just this week, there's been new developments in terms of the way that we give out citizenship. The Inspector General issued a report that found that the people that decide who gets to be citizens in this country are being pressured to approve the applications. And this is what is so important for our people to understand, folks. And that's why I come here every Friday, not to be the purveyor of gloom and doom. I know that it gets depressing and the steady drumbeat of the things that are wrong, the things that are broken, the things that need fixing. But, you know, the first step in problem solving is to identify the problems. You can't fix a problem you're not willing to acknowledge or identify. That's my goal. To get on the radio with you for this hour every week and discuss the issues of the day. Usually I have a guest this week. It's a solo act. It's me, myself, and I. I will try to keep things interesting for you, and certainly you're welcome to call in. The number here is 310-982-4145, 310-982-4145. Be delighted to take your calls. But my perspective is that we really got to secure the borders. It's not about xenophobia, and we've got to be courageous about it. We really need to be courageous. And what do I mean by courageous? So many people are cowed, or you know, caused to back down. Someone says, oh, my God, you want to talk about immigration, you're a bigot. And people run for the hills. Oh, God, I don't want to be called a bigot. I don't want to have a confrontation. That's just too difficult. The immigration laws are not about bigotry. If they were about bigotry, I could never have enforced the laws. In fact, if anything, it's the immigrants who tend to suffer the most. Pardon me, Freddy the Frog or whatever is taking up residence in my throat this evening. it's the immigrants who suffer the worst. And it's not just in one community, but all communities, whether we talk about the Asian community, whether we talk about the Latin American community, whether we talk about the African or the Caribbean community. Unfortunately, criminals will seek to ply their trades wherever they can go. They look for opportunities. When they can get to our country, they're able to evade law enforcement officers in their own country. When they come to our country, they find new markets that they can exploit, whether it's to sell drugs, whether it's to commit mail fraud, whether it's to rob or extort, to commit organized crime. The Italian mob came to America from Italy, you know. The Israelis have sent us criminals. I worked with the Israeli National Police for many years as an agent. You know, I spent 30 years with the INS. It's not about bigotry. It's about protecting everyone who lives here. America is supposed to be a country of people from all over the world. We are. E pluribus unum. That's the American dream. This idea that people from the four corners of the planet could come to America and form a united country. And what politicians have done, and this is why people, I think, are so disgusted, is they pander to any group that they think can offer them some kind of, you know, vote, money, power, influence, whatever it is they're looking for. And it's usually two things that they want. They want money, they want votes. It's remarkable. When I was on Neil Cavuto's program, he said to me, Mike, don't just think that the Obama administration, by not enforcing the laws, is pandering to the Latino community. Don't you think that his goal is to get their votes, and then he in turn protects them? And I said to Neil, I said, well, look, Neil, is that what's in the Constitution, to protect your base or protect your citizens? And of course, tongue in cheek, but he was right, Neil said, no, they're looking to protect their base. And that's where the problem lies. Let me just grab a cup of tea here. That's better. Maybe I can get rid of this irritating frog in my throat. You know, the whole point is to make certain that we are a nation of laws that respects people's dignity, people's rights, people's lives, people's potential for success. The country, the goal of every country should be to look out for its citizens before it looks out for anybody else. You know, every once in a while, we will see a terrible tragedy unfold in the news. There's a house fire, a boat capsizes, some terrible tragedy. And you see parents racing into burning buildings to pull their children out first. It's human nature. It's as instinctive as breathing. You try to save your kids first. You will never see somebody complaining that a parent, a mother or father, ran into a burning building and saved their children before they saved other kids. It would be crazy to expect someone to run into a burning building and save other children before you save your own. It's crazy for a country to look out for the well-being of aliens before looking out for the benefit of their own citizens. But that's what we keep seeing. We see it constantly. There's the steady drumbeat that the politicians talk about. We've got to bring in foreign workers. We've got to bring in foreign workers. We have to spark creativity. We're a nation with over 300 million Americans. And there's not enough creativity here? Think about what a slap in the face this is to every American, whether you're working, out of work, working on a job that doesn't pay enough and doesn't represent your talents and your aspirations. Think of what that statement is. If we can't find foreigners to bring here, we're doomed because dopey Americans won't do it. At the bottom rung, we won't do the work, and in the high-tech jobs, we can't do the work. Boy, we're a bunch, I tell you, us Americans. And who has the nerve to say this? Politicians who want our vote. If we can vote for a politician who says that Americans are too lazy to do backbreaking work and too stupid to do the high-tech jobs, if you vote for that politician, you've proven that he's right. We are too stupid. How do you get away with talking to American people and try to get them to vote for you by saying, if we don't import smart people, we're doomed? And then I look at who we've elected to office, and maybe they're right. Because there's a lot of nincompoops in Washington, and there's bigger idiots called the voters who enable these people to get those jobs. If you can possibly vote for a member of Congress, if you can vote for a mayor or a governor or any other buffoon who can stand in front of microphones and without missing a beat talk about how we are not going to succeed unless we bring in the best and brightest from overseas, if you could vote for that person, God help you. Because understand what's happening. Certainly, you want to bring people in with exceptional skills, and they always talk about Albert Einstein, the quintessential immigrant. So tell me, boys and girls, how many Einsteins have we admitted in the last 50 years? There are a number of people who certainly are talented, who are extraordinary. We could run the names of people who are singular in their talents, abilities, and so forth. And if they want to come here, I want them to come here too. But most of these so-called exceptional workers are only exceptional because they will work for exceptionally low wages. That's the issue. But the politicians will stand there and say, well, if we don't bring in smart people, we're doomed. How could we be doomed? How could we be doomed? Well, these American companies won't succeed. You know what? I don't even care anymore about American companies because that's another one of these myths. How does a company have the chutzpah, as we say in Brooklyn, to declare itself an American company when it builds most of its factories overseas, when it does not pay taxes, and when it brings in foreign workers to work in the United States, and then they say to you, we're an American company? They're not saying a pledge of allegiance to the American flag. These companies are saying a pledge of allegiance to the bottom line. Now, don't get me wrong. Let's face reality. Any business, and I don't care whether they manufacture a product or they provide a service, any company exists for one purpose. They all exist for the same purpose, to turn a profit. But a profit is one thing. But a profit at any cost is too high a price. Because if in order for a company to be successful, they have to continue this trend to kick Americans in the rear end, to dismantle the American middle class, to trample the American dream, then I don't care if that company succeeds or does not succeed. Nor should you. Nor should you. There was an article in the New York Times this week, basically proclaiming the death of the American dream. That wasn't the headline. The headline, I believe it was in the New York Times, is that opportunities no longer exist in America for the poor. If you are poor in America, folks, don't plan on going anywhere. You're poor. It's almost the caste system of India, you know? If you're poor, you're going to stay poor. If you're rolling around in the dirt, don't bother getting up. You're going to wind up back in the mud anyway. The opportunities now exist for people in Europe to be upwardly mobile. Upwardly mobile is another way of talking about the American dream. The American dream was what my parents gave to me. My mother came to America ahead of the Holocaust. She was a teenage girl. She lived in a rooming house, made $3 a week back then in an umbrella factory, and still managed to scrape together a couple of pennies to put in an envelope and mail back to her mother in Poland until her mother said to her, "Don't send me any money, because the state, whoever it is at the post office, they're opening the envelopes, they're taking the money out, so I'm not getting the money anyway, so don't bother." So here was my mom, teenage girl, living in a country by herself. First order of business, by the way, was to learn English. We didn't have push-button phones back then, but you couldn't get the operator on the phone and say, "Speak to me in Polish, speak to me in Yiddish, speak to me in Spanish." No, that wasn't what happened. What happened was you learned English. If you couldn't learn English, you couldn't get a driver's license. If you couldn't learn English, you couldn't become a citizen. And by the way, people wanted to become citizens. I'm in a movie. I'm really proud of it. Robert Michael Lynch did a phenomenal job on this documentary called They Are Coming to America. I'm pleased that I have a little cameo. I appear a couple of times in his film. It's a documentary. He's a Long Island guy. He's out in the Hamptons. Used to work with Scully over at Apple, and he was involved with 9/11, and I don't want to tell you his life story, but he explained to me that when 9/11 happened, he was one of those folks that you see in the videos running for his life as the towers were coming down, and he decided that he wanted to do the work he loved, and for him, it was cinematography, and he contacted me last year and asked me if I'd be in the film, and I am, and it's interesting. Because I don't want to give away the storyline, because you really have to see this film. I hope it's a success, and it's in every movie theater and every TV in the world. But there's this mythology that every immigrant who wants to come here wants to be a citizen. And you have to see how many people he interviewed who basically said, "When I hit my target, how much money I plan to earn, I'm out of here. I'm out of here." Many of the people who come here are coming here to get money. That's the bottom line. That is money that is being transferred out of our country each and every year. That is money that is not being earned by Americans or the lawful immigrants who really want to build their lives here. It's money that's not being spent in America. It's money that's not being invested in America. You know, I compare this business of the money being wired out of the United States to some guy who builds a swimming pool and there's a drought. And he can't wait to go swimming. I mean, this guy was born with gills. Boy, the best thing in the world for him is swimming. So he fills the pool with water, and it's during a drought, so that water costs more than usual, and he's all psyched. And in the morning, he has his breakfast, and he puts on his swim trunks, and he goes running out, and he jumps on the diving board. But luckily, before he springs off the dive board, he looks down, and to his shock, disappointment, and horror, he realizes there's an empty pool under him. He's fortunate he didn't jump. And then he goes down and he realizes that in his haste to fill the pool, he never closed the drain off. So he now has an empty pool and he has to refill it. That's America's economy. This administration has mortgaged the future of our children and their children to supposedly pump money into this economy so that we can get the economic pump running so that the people will be successful. People will make products, people will buy products, they will make other products, people will buy other products, and away we go. Of course, what they don't tell you is that most of the stuff they're making and selling came from overseas, made by people who weren't citizens, crazy stuff. But now adding to all of this other wacky business is the fact that we have millions of people in the country right now, and what do they do when they get a paycheck? They take every single penny they can squeeze out of that paycheck, and they send it to their home country. Now, I don't blame them. I would do the same thing, and I bet you would do the same thing. If you could, let's say, go to Canada, and let's say that the work that would get you a $50,000 a year paycheck in America would get you a $500,000 a year paycheck in Canada. Well, by gosh, I guess you'd head for Canada, lickety-split, get that job, get that money, and then what are you going to do with it? If you're like most people, you're going to send it back home. You will live as frugal an existence in Canada as you could and send the money home. Well, we have people from Mexico doing the same thing in America today. We have people not just from Mexico and not just from Latin America. Again, I will go back to what I have told you. I was an agent with the INS for 30 years. You know, I have a caller. Let me see who's calling in. Hi, you're talking to Mike Cutler. Who do I have the pleasure of speaking with?
Hey, Michael, Don Crosetti.
Don Crosetti, how are you, my buddy?
Good, good.
Why don't you tell folks who you are? I'm glad you called in, because this could be a very interesting conversation. I wasn't expecting to hear from you on the program, but you used to have a job at DHS, didn't you?
Yes, I got your email today and thought I'd call in. And I recently retired back in September. I worked for CIS. I was the Associate Director of Fraud Detection National Security within the Department of Homeland Security. And I'm basically the one that did the research and came up with the creation of FDNS to try to fill the gap, the void, between the Benefit Services Agency and the law enforcement and intelligence world, given Congress's decision to abolish legacy INS, and recognizing the importance of an immigration system with integrity in a post-911 world. So it's been an interesting past 8 years, and I read the recently released OIG report, and I knew you were going to address that.
Yep.
So I thought I'd call in.
Okay, well, you know, one of my big criticisms is that I don't think there's really integrity to the system, and I'm not blaming you. You know, you're a soldier in the Army, and you can only use the resources and the priorities that are made available to you by the political machinery above you. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And would you agree that there's a real problem with integrity to that process?
Yes.
What's the implications of that? I mean, you know, because people don't get it. Most politicians, when they speak about immigration, they talk about the Mexican border and we're going to go after the employers. And what they don't understand is that the more we ratchet on, and they really aren't, but the more that we go after the employers and the more that we make it hard for illegal aliens to get citizenship or a green card, rather, the more we make it hard for them to get a job, then the pressure is for them to get a green card or citizenship. So it doesn't matter whether or not we're raiding the factories. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. I mean, as you know, it's a very complex issue and very political issue. And,
right.
And it's just, you know, you got to really look at it holistically. I mean, as the 911 Commission found, I mean, the terrorists obviously abused our legal immigration system, and I think it's unfortunate it took that event to get a lot of attention on a broken immigration system.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of attention, a lot of resources, a lot of different agencies, a lot of new laws. We've made unprecedented progress, and I can tell you as a 37-year public servant and 36 of it on immigration alone, serving in the field, managing services and enforcement, coming in at the national level as a senior executive, dealing with policy development, working with the Congress, and all these issues. I mean, it's been a very exciting, challenging, frustrating, and rewarding career. And I will tell you that building the FDNS to focus the agency, CIS, on identifying and combating immigration benefit fraud and performing the necessary background checks to ensure that applicants are not a threat to national security and public safety before we issue benefits has been an extreme challenge, and that's an understatement. I mean, in the initial years, it was met with external resistance because many outside entities, including ICE, felt that we were simply
trying to... Who are some of the outside entities?
Well, we look at, when you look at the purpose of abolishing INS, and of course, is to separate, in part, to separate the enforcement and services world. When we did the research and we recognized that if we didn't have some program responsible for detecting the fraud and liaising and working with the law enforcement community, that even more fraud would continue to get by in an agency that then would simply be rubber stampers.
Yep.
So we had to build that that mechanism and that support function. And we did, and we've made absolutely unprecedented progress where we're handling better than 70% of the fraud investigations. But I don't want to waste the time and get into all that. But the bottom line is we have made unprecedented progress. The legacy culture from INS, and let's face it, the Hill, everyone was putting the pressure on the services side to produce numbers and reduce processing times in an environment and a system that was broken and not
automated. What kinds of numbers? You're talking about
we're talking
actually
millions.
Approved applications, not just moved the applications.
Absolutely, absolutely. So
I mean, look at Citizenship
forward,
USA. You're familiar with that, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. And if you fast forward now to 2012, it's just like looking at the enhancements that have made with regard to security clearances before you get a visa, collecting biometrics, having the checks done before you allow people to enter the United States. The agencies are talking, they're sharing databases, have a terror screening database that gets better and better, and all the integrated systems. So things have changed dramatically. And if I could now leap forward just to the OIG report, some of the things that came out of that with some employees in a survey reflecting that they continue to be forced to approve to get the yes, that they're forced to approve applications.
Say that again slowly because people are listening. I want to make sure they hear this. They were being forced to get to yes.
Forced
what does that
to
mean?
Get to yes.
It means that they were told that they needed to approve the applications.
Meaning approve the application, forced to get to yes without regard to suspicions of fraud or inadequate supporting evidence or documents to show that
or
they
were legal justification. Maybe the person didn't even meet the qualification.
Exactly, to show that they were eligible. And you know, I built FDNS. I'm very passionate about national security. And I'm not just speaking as an adjudications person, but I can tell you that most of the things that came out in that OIG report is old information. Now, the days of being forced to approve, absolutely false. I've had people in the agency in the past few years, adjudicators make that statement, and I have said, identify to me the case, the evidence, give it to me. No one could provide it. So when we really drilled down and had a conversation, it was really boiled down to their inability to get the evidence to deny, so they had weak denials, or they wanted to go out and request for more information, not that they were forced to approve, because that would be outright criminal and a violation, and they should be reporting that to the OIG.
Well, but wait a second, Don. Slow down. I've been letting you talk. Now let me make a couple of points.
Okay.
I've spoken to some people who are out in California who told me even though as of last year they no longer made productivity a component of their evaluation, they still had Mr. Mayorkas, who runs the program, still saying that you've got to get to yes, where when applications were denied, he brought them back and said, no, you've got to approve applications. And they reported it to OIG. They reported it to Chuck Grassley. And the way that I became aware of this was Grassley's people had reached out to me.
Yeah. No, I'm aware of the allegations, Mike.
And they're very serious. And let me ask you a question, okay? You talk about a security check, and I've testified before Congress about that. Can you describe how a security check is done?
Well, there's a variety of different security checks, but let's look at the criminal aspect first. We take the fingerprints, we collect them, and send them electronically to the FBI through IAFIS, and we get the criminal checks done that way.
IAFIS, slow down. We're talking to folks that don't have our background. What is IAFIS?
Right. Well, it's the FBI's automated information system, which takes the biometrics, the biographical information in addition, and then it bounces against their system, which contains the identification and the arrest records.
Within which country?
Within the United States.
So if someone has an outstanding warrant elsewhere, it's hit or miss whether it's going to show up. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, there's all sorts of ifs and accepts, but
I'm just asking. How often do we wind up with fingerprints, let's say from Colombia or Mexico or El Salvador, whether or not this person's a criminal in those countries?
Yeah, for the most part, you're checking the FBI records, which are records of
within the United States alone.
In the United States.
Only.
Okay. I'm unaware of any system, centralized global system, that has arrest.
No, that's fine. I'm just trying to show where the vulnerabilities lie. So what I'm saying to you is that you don't know by looking at fingerprints if the guy is a fugitive because he just killed 30 little girls in Guadalajara, chopped their heads off, and now he's on the run. That would probably not show up by fingerprints.
Not only that, Michael. Well, not only that, you really don't know if they are who they say they are.
Now, that, I was going to get to that next, because what you're doing is running a name. But, you know, when I met Jim Sensenbrenner, I'll tell you and the audience a quick funny story. You remember when George W. Bush was pushing for a guest worker program, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And I met Sensenbrenner at an event. I used to write for the counterterrorism blog, and we were going to speak, and he came in to do a little introduction and be with us and then leave, and he came up. He knew who I was. And I told him that I was concerned that he was pushing the guest worker program. And he said, what's wrong? I said, how would you prevent a bad guy from getting an official identity document that a false name and using it as an embedding tactic? Well, once I explained it, he said, slow down and give me some examples. Let's really have this conversation. And I said, let's say Bin Laden, is alive. He changes his appearance. His fingerprints don't show up in our database because we've never fingerprinted him. And he says his name is Donald Duck. They run the prints, they come back clean, because this is an FBI database, not an international database. The name Donald Duck comes back clean. Within 24 to 48 hours, Bin Laden would get a new identity that proclaimed to the world that his name is Donald Duck. He would then be able to get a driver's license, social security cards, open bank accounts, get on board airplanes, travel freely around America, and work at places that have national security implications. And by the way, I would certainly include food processing plants as critical infrastructure. I certainly worry about who handles our food. So you look at that possibility. Where are we now? Are we better off or not so well off when we have false security? You know, the only thing worse than no security is false security. Would you agree with me or disagree, Don?
Well, I agree, but I don't think it's practical. You know, there's only so much that we can do with the records the United States has. And I'm sure the FBI has fingerprints and biographic information on individuals overseas, too, because they have countries that they cooperate and they get all sorts of biometrics. But as a rule, we are conducting a check of U.S. records.
Okay, but what we're talking about is a check, not a background investigation. Would you agree with that?
No, it's just a criminal biometric and biographic check of
records. A biographic
the
is a name check. A biographic,
is a name check. It comes with the name, date of birth, place of birth, that type of information.
So if the name is a false name,
number.
It doesn't work.
Correct.
Okay.
So if the FBI doesn't, let's say the FBI doesn't have a record, and this individual submitted, and we took their fingerprints, signature, biographic information, we put it in our system, we transmit it to the FBI. They don't have a record. At least we don't have a record of them having a record. And we don't know if they are who they really say they are, because there are, as you know, there are a lot of people who can get legitimate passports under assumed identities that are very secure and come into the United States. There's no doubt about it.
Look at this, this is not a perfect world. 19 terrorists in the aggregate used 364 false names and variations of false identities. 364,
exactly.
19 people.
Right. So in our world, whether they go to the State Department and they get their biometrics collected and they meet the eligibility and there's no negative records and they get the visa, they come in.
Mm-hmm.
Their names, then we get them and their names and they apply for benefits. We got their names. We check records, no records. Now, they may not be who they say they are, but the one good thing that we never were able to do before all this technology and IAFIS was implemented and everything, back under the legacy INS days, is we can at least collect it, store it electronically, run electronic checks, and now we have them. Now, they may not really be who they say they are, but they are from here on out. And now when the law enforcement agencies, police, whatever, they get arrested, they get charged, it goes into the criminal justice information system, which we're bouncing against. We'll get aware of the records. We know they've been arrested. If someone else, and this happens occasionally, someone surfaces, applies for a benefit under their name, yet someone else already assumed the name and submitted different biometrics, then all of a sudden it hits, there's a conflict, we look at it, then we go back to the other individual, and they get caught. And that's happening all the time now as U.S. visit continues to develop and we run all our biometrics checks.
For my audience, U.S. Visit, describe that system.
Well, the U.S. Visit has a system that basically is for DHS DHS, the centralized storage of all the biometrics, and it bounces against various databases in the criminal and the national security environment. And I don't want to go beyond that, but it does a lot of checks that were never done before, and we send our biometrics to the FBI through U.S. Visit. U.S. Visit is also engaged in doing recurrent vetting service through terror screening databases and other databases. I mean, this government has truly made tremendous progress, and I'm happy to say the CIS has been part of that. I think we
Citizenship and Immigration Services is the CIS we're talking about. Yes,
exactly.
USCIS.
I think the old days, we're trying our best, and we've succeeded, but we've got a ways to go. I mean, it takes years to change a culture that was weaned on numbers and productivity.
Well, you know what I find interesting about USCIS? We've been at it now for almost 10 years. It was one of the recommendations, one of the key recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. They gave overall responsibility to the U.S. Visit to a company called Accenture. They used to be headquartered in Hamilton, Bermuda. Now they're headquartered in Ireland. I have nothing against either Bermuda or Ireland, but I find it funny that an offshore company is doing national security work by subcontract to the U.S. government. And we still don't have good departure control. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, as far as I know, I mean, that's not my area of responsibility, but I don't think the departure control is anywhere.
But that's
near
one of the critical issues, and I'll tell you why I believe we don't have departure control, Don. I believe it comes back to the visa waiver program, because there was supposed to be a 3% denial rate on visas, and that's easy. You could just tell State Department, give out more visas. But as far as 3% overstay rate, My cynicism, and it runs rampant when I speak about the government. You have a couple more years than I do, although I have 30-odd years' worth of experience in. They're pushing hard for this program. And I believe that they knew that if they had accurate departure control, they would know that probably almost no country on that 36th list of countries that participate in visa waiver would qualify, because their citizens, you know, they're exceeding that 3%. I'm also concerned that we push for continuation of the visa waiver program at a time that we're losing six or seven valuable tools that the visa waiver program, that the visa requirement gives us. You can't prosecute somebody for filling out a false visa application if they're not filling out a visa application in the first place. See, the point that I'm trying to make, Don, is that if you look at the way the system is geared up, it's still geared up to meet the political ends of the people in power in Washington, and that very often conflicts with what's in the best interest of America and Americans. You know, a background check is not a background investigation. Let me just finish. And I made this point with Sheila Jackson Lee, because she was touting background checks when I testified before the House Judiciary Committee at a field hearing in Dubuque, Iowa. And I said, you know, a background investigation is arduous. We underwent that because you and I both had security clearances. Every 5 years, you know, we had to go through the Inquisition. They would take our photograph into the street, ask people, who is this guy? If suddenly Mike Cutler had three other names, they'd want to know why, and they'd run all those leads to ground. How long does a background check take? About a minute?
Right. Well, I tell you, the FBI has done such a great job now that the overwhelming majority, probably better than 90% of the biometrics we send to them, are completely processed within a matter of a couple hours, if not minutes.
Okay, so I understand my point. That's fine, but it's not a background investigation. And when you look at the idea about the law, a law got passed, let me just make the point, a law got passed that said if you lie on a visa application, it's a 10-year felony. If the lie on that application was committed so that you can commit a crime in America, that you're coming here to do a kidnapping or rob a bank, now you're talking about a 15-year felony. If the felony involves narcotics, it's a 20-year rap for visa fraud, 25 years if it's in furtherance of terrorism. Could that prosecution take place under the visa waiver program? No, because there's no visa application. All I'm saying to you is I've seen this as an agent, and I've seen it since I left the agency, that we keep trying to create illusions that everything is being handled when I don't think it really is. And I'm not blaming you. I blame the bureaucracy, and I blame how we've politicized immigration. Is that an unreasonable concern?
Well, absolutely not. But is it going to change? What do you think?
Well, I think we have to force it to change. The American people have allowed themselves to listen to the nonsense that comes out of Washington. You know, we're being told we're going to give you a virtual fence. I've been on Lou Dobbs about 80 times. I've given up counting how many public appearances. And I said that the virtual fence would stop virtually nobody. And that's exactly what happened. I was on with Neil Cavuto a couple of days ago, and we were talking about the drones. I said, why in blazes are we using drones when manned helicopters are cheaper, takes fewer people to maintain helicopters, and you have armed agents in the chopper who can land and assist a Border Patrol agent who's being attacked, make an arrest, and look for people to back them up. All a drone can do is take pictures, and you still have to get out there to make that arrest or back up the people who are being attacked. We have this tendency to spend lots of money on high-tech so-called solutions that more often than not just spend lots of money and create an illusion of security that doesn't match the reality of the situation. That's my concern, Don.
And I don't disagree with you, but the difference in today's world with the technology that has advanced the way it has is that we really shouldn't just continue to pour money into the operations and hire more people and boots on the ground, because that's like putting water on a fire. You're always going to have a fire. You're never going to address the real causes and the solutions. So we really do need some radical change. Our laws are outdated.
If you became emperor, what would you do? Give me your top three. How would you fix what's broke?
Well, first of all, I think that the three ingredients to really instilling integrity into our legal immigration system, one is reactive. It's what we're talking about. It's operational. You got to continue to be effective in detecting and combating the fraud and screening the people and building your systems to continue to do that.
How would you combat the fraud?
All right, the second thing I would do is you got to get the data from all of your arrests, from all your investigations, identify what the fraud indicators and causes are, and then you have to build the systems to be able to identify that fraud, particularly in the immigration service area. Mm-hmm. At the time of filing, you've got to identify their risk at the time of filing. You've got to bounce that data that we collect against all of our systems, including the Fraud Detection National Security System, of all the leads and all the cases completed and pending. You also have to build a system at the time of filing that collects information that you continue to analyze using analytics-type software. And if you look at the more global system, look what the country has done as far in collecting biometrics and controlling travel into the United States. So it's now more difficult to get into the United States. We got records. We collect. We use airline data. We're using the data we collect from the aliens, the biometrics, and biographical information.
All right, let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question.
What?
And I had this conversation with Mike Chertoff. We both spoke at Chapman Law School. How many applications for benefits were you processing in a given year?
I do believe the average is 6 to 7 million applications.
And how many investigators were available to look for fraud?
Under what, Legacy INS?
Right now. How many? For example, how rampant is marriage fraud? My understanding is it could go to maybe 90%. People getting married and not living together, if it's a onesie, as Chertoff called it. Who's making certain that couple lives together? Are there random
90%.
Spot checks being done?
Well,
see, my point is
90%.
This.
Michael, you're asking me questions, but you're not letting me answer.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry, Don.
I don't know where you get the 90%. In all the cases that we reviewed and managed, I would say that marriage fraud is in the double-digit arena, but I would say on the lower side of the double-digit, I wouldn't say that it's anywhere near 90%.
I would also say
that I think that marriage fraud is very hard to prove. People are getting much more advanced. I think I read an article the other day from one of the ICE agents that was saying people are getting smarter. They're learning to live together, even though the intention is not to really remain as man and wife, as a family unit, but rather to beat the system and wait a while and get the green card and then split. So, you know, that kind of fraud is extremely difficult to prove. So they are getting smarter.
Well, you know, I was an adjudicator and I was an agent in the frauds unit, and I got to work both sides of it. And I don't think a lot of them, they may be going to that extreme, but I think a lot of them know that they don't even need to go to that extreme. You know, when I spoke to Mike Chertoff, he had said, well, we almost never investigate onesies. He flat out told me that.
Well, ICE doesn't, which is why we built FDNS. See, the difference between CIS, Citizenship and Immigration Services, and ICE, the Immigration Customs Enforcement, They're focused on criminal violations, and when they accept an investigation, that's usually multi-conspiracy, multi-party type fraud involving hundreds if not thousands of aliens and that crosses state lines. And when they conduct when they accept a case and open an investigation, their objective, if they prove fraud, is to indict, you know, prosecute, convict, incarcerate, and then remove.
All right, now, here's my question to you, a couple quick follow-ups. Chertoff wasn't over you when he was Secretary of Homeland Security?
Well, sure. He,
but my point is, he told
everybody.
Me, let me tell you what Mike Chertoff told me sitting in the back of that limo for 45 minutes, because we were both good at, we had dinner and then we were on our way to the hotel, and the next day we both spoke at the event at the school. He said that they didn't have the time, the resources, or the money to look at onesies, period. Now, we're talking about DHS, not just ICE. That's number one. Number two, when you go to the ICE website and you see all these takedowns of these organizations that have brought in sometimes thousands of people with phony visas, at least the press release never focuses on the aliens being sought, only on the illegal operation where they've arrested the lawyer and the four notary republics and the six other people. So they'll talk about how 12 people were indicted, but where they were responsible for bringing in thousands of aliens, but there's no reference being made, at least in the press releases, that anyone's even looking for the other people. That's a problem. And I mean, that's how they're producing. Now, maybe you guys did go after them, but when you look at the press release issued by the Justice Department or issued by ICE saying that they've arrested 12 people who are responsible for bringing in thousands, when you look at it, let me give you a specific case that I saw that had my hair standing on end. The guy's name was Fezhazian. He was a guy from Eritrea. And apparently he was arrested for alien smuggling. And they were touting the fact that they got this alien smuggler. And in the report, they talked about how he came here as an illegal alien, ran the border, got political asylum. And at the time that he claimed to be running for his life in Eritrea, he was in Guatemala smuggling aliens from Africa through Guatemala into the United States. But there wasn't a single word in that entire press release, and it was a long press release, and it was by the Justice Department as well as by ICE. No one said a word about them trying to strip this guy of his lawful status as a refugee, which means that if he kept his refugee status, they likely would not even deport him, even if he did time for smuggling. And, you know, these folks notoriously don't get more than 2 years in jail, because I always look at the sentencing amounts of time. It doesn't matter that the law says their exposure is decades. They usually get, you know, 18 months, 24 months. And if he still has political asylum, he's not going to be deported, even though it was a bogus claim for asylum. So my concern is when I'm looking at the material being put out there by the agency itself, we're not talking about the newspaper that doesn't know what they're talking about or a reporter on a radio show who doesn't know what we're talking about. I look to see what ICE has to say, and there wasn't a word in there that said, well, now that we recognize that this guy defrauded the system and got political asylum that he wasn't entitled to it, so we're going to go after that. They didn't say that. They just said, we brought this smuggler to justice. Do you follow my concern?
Yes, yes.
I mean, is anybody going after the 1,000 people he brought into the country? I doubt it, because you don't have the resources to arrest them.
Well, that's part of the systemic problem with all the major criminal conspiracies that agents, as you know, having been one, you tend to only prosecute the two or three primary ringleaders. And then the aliens that gained by the fraud are not prosecuted, and those files in the past would just go back to the shelf. Mm-hmm. And then those aliens who immigrated based on fraud would file more petitions to bring other people in the country. Now, what we've been doing for the past 7 years, 8 years since we created FDNS, is working with ICE that when they prosecute those ringleaders, we look at all the other alien files to determine which ones were engaged in the fraud, and then we pursue initiation revocation of the visas that they have. But I will tell you that it doesn't work as smoothly as it sounds, because we're talking big numbers and, as you said, very limited resources. So they've been identified. They're sitting ready for an officer to review so that we could initiate the revocation proceedings.
So we could initiate, but it's not done. They're very often sure that they don't have the time to do it anyway. But you know what's amazing to me?
Right, could take years.
And I'm not picking on you. I told you this at the outset. I'm not trying to beat up on you.
I'm
just trying
to sound defensive. The system. It's the system.
And that's my point. But meanwhile, do you know how many people work for TSA? It floored me. Do you know how many people are employed by TSA?
I have no idea. Over what, 40, 50,000?
Over 60,000.
Yeah, okay.
And Mike Chertoff was telling me we don't have the money to hire more ICE agents, and we only had 7,000 ICE agents. And how many investigators did you have, 500?
We're approaching 700. But I will tell you, Michael, it's kind of like the federal government versus the state government. How involved do you want? How many federal resources do we want GS-13 special agents investigating lower-level fraud that an assistant U.S. attorney is unlikely to prosecute? And I would think the answer to that is no.
But now look at what happens, though.
That's why you got FDNS. So we're the ones, and our objective, I had mentioned that ICE objective is you prove fraud, you indict, you prosecute, you convict, you incarcerate, and then you remove. CIS looks at it like, okay, well, our objective isn't criminal because that's ICE's role. So we're going to focus on proving the fraud, validate or invalidate the fraud. If you prove the fraud, give your investigative report to the adjudicator, deny the petition, put the alien in removal proceedings. I know that's all screwed up, too, but, I mean, we won't.
Let me stop you right there.
Okay.
You know, deny the application. And meanwhile, I still have people telling me that they were told to get to yes.
Well, that's another issue. But I don't really believe that the get to yes is being – first of all, I don't know. I've never heard our director say that. I've heard people say that he said that, but I have never heard.
You're right. I'm doing this hearsay, too, and I want to be fair to Mr. Mayorkas, but someone told me, and I take this to be authoritative, that the statement was – that there's no fraud, only misunderstandings. Now, if you have a boss who says that...
You know, when I heard that, I talked to him about that. And
what did you
absolutely,
hear?
That absolutely not, he wouldn't say that. And I would tell you, I've had every director CIS has supported FDNS. And I got to tell you, Mayorkas, to my surprise, being a former U.S. attorney, he comes in, he clearly understands enforcement. He has advanced the FDNS mission more than his predecessors, and they have been very proactively supportive as well. He would not do that. He's very focused on combating fraud. He gave me 300 positions since he's been here.
All right, let me ask you another question, though. There were stories about adjudicators getting gift cards for Target and other stores if they were successful and productive. Is that an accurate statement? You were probably there during that era.
Well, I'm not familiar about that, but I am familiar.
Well, there were two allegations that they were getting purchase cards and they were getting time-off rewards for productivity.
Well, I know as a manager that there's a non-monetary recognition incentive awards process that all federal agencies use. And the idea there is it's an inexpensive way to recognize contributions in a very inexpensive way to motivate people to perform. So I do know that over the years, certain agencies would get things like that and give them to employees for recognizing.
I don't have a problem with it. All I'm asking you is this. If you were being rewarded for productivity, that means how many applications you can move. So now let me ask you the next follow-up question, if we're talking about productivity. How long does it take to approve an application? How long does it take to write a denial?
Well, there's no doubt about it that a denial takes considerably more time.
How much time? Just to give my audience, I mean, we both know what we're talking about. I'm trying to be informative for the folks who are out there.
All right, well, real quick, there's different types of forms. Some of them are more complex. Some take longer. Some denials might take you a couple days to write, might take a couple hours to write.
Okay, but we're talking a minimum of hours.
Hours, at a minimum.
At a minimum. And how long does an approval take?
Approval could take minutes to hours. And then denials could take hours to days.
Okay. So certainly if you're oriented to simply move as many pieces of paper as possible, you've already been given an incentive to approve as many as possible.
Yes. And I'm saying I don't deny that. I think over the years, particularly under Legacy INS and even the early stages of USCIS, that there was a disproportionate emphasis on productivity as opposed to making
when did that
sure
end?
The applicant is eligible before you grant the benefit.
When did that – you and I both have a common friend, our friend Neil Jacobs, who testified before Congress.
Yes.
And he came to call Citizenship USA the Jiffy Lube process and quickly found himself out of a job as chief of an office. In point of fact, he had almost zero fraud referrals. Now, that was under the old INS, the legacy INS. So my question to you is, how much better are we today than then? Because what I'm hearing is that we're not particularly better, and we still have an administration who talks now about giving employment authorization to aliens who are here illegally, and nothing has happened to change their status. It's a de facto amnesty for people, hundreds of thousands from what I had read in newspaper accounts. So the pressure still has to be on to not look to enforce, but look to provide opportunities for people who shouldn't be here, is what I'm reading into what I'm reading in the papers. Is that unfair?
I think it's inaccurate.
How so?
I think going back to Neil, Neil ran into issues that were well beyond his statements about Citizenship USA being Jiffy Lube. So I won't go any further than just
say
that.
Okay, that's fine.
But
fair
Neil,
enough.
Neil is also a good friend and a former colleague who survived that and ended up being one of the ICE Identity Benefit Fraud Unit chiefs that worked with me.
I fought like hell to help him out at the time.
Oh, Neil's a great guy.
He's one of my favorite people. By the way, I was with him this Thanksgiving.
He worked with me on building the fraud unit.
I was with him just past Thanksgiving.
Oh, well, I haven't seen him in years, so I hope to tell him I said hi.
I will. But
he helped me develop the FDNS fraud unit and to work in partnership with the ICE Identity Benefit Fraud Unit. And then fast forward, Neil has had about four or five successors as we built the joint ICE-CIS anti-fraud program, and CIS has had one, me.
Right.
Okay. So we have been very steady, very focused for 7 to 8 years, and I know we still have a culture that is too production-oriented. But I will tell you, Ali Mayorkas, the director, I don't think he's been there 3 years yet. He is the only one that I recall in my 37 years, the only one that has recognized that and said, I want productivity struck from the vocabulary. It's about quality and quantity and integrity, and we have to demonstrate they're eligible and they're not a threat before we grant benefits. He had them remove it from the work plans, and last year, and this is unprecedented, listen to this, you're going to love this.
Brilliant.
Last year, he took the fraud detection and national security priorities that we developed and made them the agency's national number one priority. And he incorporated it into the work plans of the managers. Now, does that sound like a director that's ordering adjudicators to approve?
No, but it doesn't.
This is old news. People are full of it. I'm telling you that, Michael. Now, there is.
I hope you're right.
It's going to take a while because just last year, fiscal year 11, is the first year we got FDNS priorities into the CIS national priorities.
You know, I have to tell you, I'm sure you know who Eduardo Aguirre was. And Mr. Aguirre testified before I did, back in 05, I think it was, about resources. And he said his three priorities. Priority one was to clear up the backlog of applications. Priority two was enhance customer service. Priority three was national security. And I said, how in blazes can priority three be national security behind customer service? So, you know, this is a long-standing tradition in this outfit.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm going to go back to Aguirre. Eduardo Aguirre was a banker, as you know.
He came from the Bank of America, the private international bank, and he was a globalist. He got awards from, he got honorary degrees from Beijing and Santo Domingo, and he bragged about that.
There you go. Listen, I don't want to be critical of politicians, but if you look back in history and you look at various political appointees to include appointees to very high-level cabinet positions, you look at the backgrounds of these people and you tell me the majority of them are qualified.
Oh, I agree with you. You want Mike Cutler to argue with you? That's not going to happen, Don.
So when you get these people in there, they mean well and they'll say things, but it's the institution, it's bureaucrats that really influence them. And the one thing that Aguirre learned after his first several months here is he learned by observation, and he didn't get to be a CEO for nothing and to be as advanced as he is and as independent and wealthy that he is, successful that he is. He observed, and he, after a number of months, he attached himself to people that he respected and trusted. And as soon as he did that, one of those individuals was a guy named Bill Yates, and you probably know Bill. goes back, was a legacy agent, ran the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, also had services background, ran one of the centers. And when INS was abolished, he came over to be the senior career executive over domestic operations for CIS. Bill was the guy that called me when INS was abolished. I was a district director in Baltimore at the time, and he asked me to come in and research the void with no enforcement and intelligence component in a benefit agency. And I agreed to do it, and that's what ended up with FDNS. And while Gary didn't understand immigration, he took the senior level of trusting us, believing in us, covering for us, dealing with the political aspects of it, and we were able to actually create and advance FDNS. After Aguirre left, because he became, I believe, an ambassador to Spain, then we get Emilio Gonzalez. Emilio Gonzalez came from career military with...
But he also worked for a law firm that claimed that they had people in key government positions who could help overcome obstacles and create possibilities. I'm trying to remember the name of that law firm.
Well, I don't know about that, but he
was... Yeah, it
was
right on the website. They took it down after I wrote about it.
He was an intelligence officer, and he worked for the National Security Desk, National Security Council, and responsible for the Western Hemisphere. So my point here is we end up getting a military person with an intel background. He comes in. He gave FDNS even more support and resources. He leaves. Then we get Ali Mayorkas, who was a former U.S. attorney, who personally prosecuted immigration criminal offenses. And he gives us even more and supports us even more. I'm telling you, things are changing, but people are still dealing with the old information, the old news. Now, does that mean CIS has completely changed their culture? Absolutely not. Every day was a challenge for me within CIS. I could not accomplish a lot of things before I retired, and like you, I remain passionate about instating integrity in our legal immigration system. So I will, on my own time as a retiree, continue to advocate certain things that need to be done that I couldn't get done as a senior executive, as an employee, but I'm hoping I can get the attention just like what you do in trying to get the attention from the right people to get certain changes and enhancement made, because we have to do that. It's about the national security of this country. And while we've come a long way, we've got a long ways to go.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, I got to tell you, it's a delight to chat with you, Don. And you know, I may not agree with you on all the points, but that's what makes life interesting.
Absolutely.
But, I think what really we need to understand is just how important it is that we really have a system that really has integrity. And you know, Doris Meisner used to say that we needed to be customer-oriented, and I used to disagree with her on one point. She thought the customers were the illegal aliens. I believe the customers are the citizens of the United States of America. I want to make sure that the way that we enforce immigration laws, while providing opportunities for people to legally immigrate to America, first and foremost, considers the well-being, the security, and the safety of America and Americans. And I think that that's where Doris Meisner and I part company, and it's not an inconsequential point of departure.
And, you know, Michael, I agree with you, and we're in a much better position today in 2012 than we were ever in the 1900s, especially from the 70s to the 90s. Because now technology is so great. I mean, servicing the people that are entitled to benefits is very important, but you don't do it at the risk of national security and public safety. And with today's technology, there is a way to truly do that and to facilitate the processing by making sure that we do all the security and fraud checks first. And it's getting better and better and better, and it's very exciting.
Well, it is, but again, I will tell you that the shortcoming that I see is that people are easily, because of desktop publishing and all kinds of other issues, that's why identity theft is now the number one white-collar crime in America. We don't always know who we're dealing with. And if we were to, I am 100% against any kind of an amnesty, of comprehensive immigration reform. I think it's a terrible mistake. And the one point that I think that the people out there need to understand, you may disagree with me, but you and I both know that if we had to process the 20 or 30 million applications that we would likely be actually dealing with, you could not even do face-to-face interviews. This would be a mail transaction. Is that an unreasonable supposition on my part?
No, I agree with you, and I would not advocate an amnesty program that would give millions of people even temporary residence. But I would also argue that with today's technology and the way the system works, as long as you collect the biometrics and do the checks, I'm not convinced that you really need to interview everybody. I think you look at the high risk, you do your systems checks through biometrics and other systems, especially the national security databases, and then you move on.
I'll tell you why I disagree with you. Because if you're not doing the fingerprinting at the location, which is why I don't like remote fingerprinting, there is nothing to prevent somebody from submitting someone else's fingerprints.
Oh, yes, it is. That's totally changed now.
How do you prevent that?
All of our biometrics, you must go into a USCIS application support center with government-issued identification
We do have a form of a face-to-face is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
See, and when you say no face-to-face, then you're not doing that. Do you understand my point?
What I'm talking about, the no face-to-face, is on the back end. Value is bringing somebody in, looking over a paper application and asking questions that you know what they're going to tell you? The real focus, especially on high volume, is let's make sure we collect their biometrics, we have them from here on out, bounce them against the national security and public safety databases, see if we have any derogatory information, and if we don't, move on. Those that look questionable, interview, interrogate.
Okay. I still have misgivings, but at least that makes me feel a little bit better. You've increased my optimism by 0.5%.
Well, I've been spending the last 15 years working on this. So.
But I think you know where my heart and where my head are on this issue, Don.
Well, it's in the right place. But we really have to try to come up with a new immigration system and laws, because the current system was not built for now. I mean, even our removal proceedings with EOIR, all of that, everything needs to be totally revamped.
Well, I'll tell you what I would do with that, and we're running short on time, but let me tell you and my audience out there what I would do with that. If you have an alien who has been convicted of violent felonies, drug felonies, sex offenders, as far as I'm concerned, they should be ordered deported and let them file any appeal of that order from their home country.
Well, I agree with you. I also ask the question, and I'm not a lawyer, but I also ask the question, why is a foreign national who is in this country in violation of the law entitled to a very expensive and time-consuming process, due process?
On the administrative side, I don't disagree with you. Criminally, they have to have due process, but not from the deportation. Administratively, immigration is kind of like the bouncer at the disco. You've misbehaved, you're out of here.
You crossed the border illegally or you overstayed your visit. Why in the world are you entitled to go to all these different pleadings, merits hearings, stretch it out for 2 years, spend
you
so
don't
much
know the
money
reason
on
to
lawyers
that?
And attorneys?
Wait a minute.
Well,
you don't
I
know,
do. I'm being facetious in asking that question.
No, I know
I think
you are. I'm joking
that's
with
what
you.
We need, that's what we need to change.
And by the way, when you look at comprehensive reform, and you know probably what happened, I provided an article and Senator Sessions quoted me from the floor of the Senate on 3 separate days. I almost fell over because I got to hear him at one point, and it gave me goosebumps that lasted about 3 hours. I came to call the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act the way they wanted to do things. Why don't I tell them what I really think, Don?
Really?
But here's the deal, okay? You look at that whole business about that. Who would have to pay for the legal fees for the illegal aliens? You and I would. I want to know why, if you and I have to pay for our own tax preparer, if legal immigrants have to go and pay for their own attorneys, why somehow an illegal alien would get free legal counsel? And look at the amnesty program where we weren't allowed to disclose material contained in the amnesty files, even to the FBI or the police or anybody, because that was supposed to be shielded from scrutiny. How insane was that whole business?
Exactly.
So, you know, I think what you and I are, we may not have identical ideologies, and that's fine. You know, there's parallax. Nobody sees things from exactly the same perspective. But, I have to make this point, folks. Don did as best a job as he could with limited tools that he had to try to get the job done. I think sometimes you're a little bit overly optimistic on what can be achieved, but again, it's a matter of parallax. We come from different perspectives and so forth. I have my different opinions about Bill West also. One day I'll have to talk to you about that off air. You know, I was removed because I dared testify before Congress without authority. Of course, that wasn't the official excuse, but I know that that Bill was behind that. We had an interesting exchange after I did that hearing about Muhammad Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi.
I pressed a button.
Yeah, well, you know, I have to tell you, the immigration laws are probably among America's most important laws. And I think that we've forgotten that because politicians have been looking for the gains that they can get out of this immigration system on both sides of the aisle, which is how we got into this mess in the first place. And I think it's time that people came to the realization that the immigration laws, just like everything else about America, is supposed to serve first and foremost the citizens of America before we start. Look at VAWA, by the way, the Violence Against Women's Act. We have fraud being committed where aliens are claiming they're being abused so they can self-petition. And I helped an attorney because some woman was trying to claim her husband assaulted her so that she could get a green card when he figured out that she was marrying him just for the green card. I was able to help him, and she ultimately went back to Russia. But, you know, it was a remarkable case. So, you know, we see these kinds of abuses
everywhere.
All the time, and the saddest part of it all is that the most likely victims of this stuff are the citizens of the country.
Yes, and now in a post-911 world, the security and safety of those citizens.
Yep. So that's why I'm glad you contributed your voice to my program. I was flying solo today. It was a pleasant surprise to see your number pop up on my control panel here.
Well, thanks for the email because that reminded me.
Well, I'll give you a call a little bit later on for a brief chat, Don. But I'm so glad you joined us, folks. I have to tell you, I'm glad you joined me this evening. You know what I try to do every Friday night is provide perspectives and information you're not going to get anywhere else. I don't think you've been on any TV or radio program before, have you, Don?
No, my plan was I retired on September 30th. I was taking the rest of the calendar year off, and now I'm starting to re-engage a little bit. So
okay,
I've been
well,
declining all those interviews and everything.
Well, so here we are. So I actually got to do the first interview that you've done. And so there you go, folks. You have a first.
Thank you very much,
but
Michael.
But, you know, it really is important. Huh?
I look forward to talking to you and maybe joining you again. Maybe we can talk about some ideas on how to reform the current operational and the laws.
I look forward to that conversation, Don.
All right. Take care.
Okay, I thank you for calling. Folks, I hope you've enjoyed this past hour. It's certainly been interesting for me. Don is an old friend and somebody who I certainly know. And as you can see, my concerns remain steadfast, as I believe Don's as well. We've got to make the system work. And the system will not work until and unless our government recognizes that it's there to serve the people of the United States. And that's the goal of our government. Simply stated, Americans need to come first, especially where their own government is concerned. If we're going to say a pledge of allegiance to the American flag, it's time that the politicians who claim that they are there to represent us say a pledge of allegiance to their constituents and the citizens of this country. I thank you so much for joining me this past hour. I hope you join me again next week at the same time. I will try to provide you with an interesting hour of information and interviews and stuff that you will hear no place else. Have a great weekend, everybody. See you next week.